Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. Parents can send instant money transfers, automate allowance, and more. Plus, keep an eye on spending with real-time notifications. Join more than 6 million families building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey. That's greenlight.com/odyssey.
We all belong outside. We're drawn to nature, whether it's the recorded sounds of the ocean we doze off to or the succulents that adorn our homes. Nature makes all of our lives, well, better. Despite all this, we often go about our busy lives removed from it. But the outdoors is closer than we realize. With AllTrails, you can discover trails nearby and explore confidently. With offline maps and on-trail navigation, download the free app today and make the most of your summer with AllTrails.
Hello and welcome to The Sidebar, presented by True Crime Daily, taking you inside the courtrooms of high-profile and notorious cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a criminal defense lawyer based in Los Angeles and previously an LA County prosecutor for nearly a decade. You can find me on all social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. We are recording this on Friday, April 26, 2024. In this week's episode, a landmark conviction of the Me Too era is overturned as New York's Court of Appeals rules that Harvey Weinstein did not receive a fair trial in the mogul sexual assault case. Plus, an OnlyFans model charged with killing her boyfriend is back in court after allegations that she and her parents attempted to destroy evidence using the victim's laptop. But first, the heated debate surrounding a rancher who allegedly shot a migrant worker to death leaves a jury deadlocked, necessitating the judge to declare a mistrial. Let's jump right into these cases. First, breaking news out of Santa Cruz County, Arizona. A judge has declared a mistrial after jurors failed to reach a verdict on charges related to the shooting of an unarmed migrant on a rancher's border property. 75-year-old George Allen Kelly faced one count of second-degree murder and two counts of aggravated assault in the shooting death of Gabriel Cuen Butamea. Prosecutors allege Kelly fired 9 shots from his AK-47 from a distance of over 100 yards at a group of unarmed migrants who were walking across his ranch. Kelly's defense claims that the man only fired warning shots at what he thought may have been armed drug dealers. Butamea suffered a severed aorta in the shooting. However, the fatal bullet was never found, further complicating the case. Jurors deliberated across 3 days, asking to re-examine evidence from the police reports before making multiple declarations to the judge that they were at an impasse. A mistrial was declared, and it will now be up to prosecutors to determine if Kelly will be retried on the charges, with a status hearing scheduled for Monday, April 29th. Well, first of all, let's talk a little bit about why we think this case was difficult for jurors to wrap their heads around, or at least for them to all agree on how they felt about this case. The strengths for the prosecution, at least, are a few things. One, this shooting took place at over 100 yards. And just think about that. Over a football field of distance between Kelly and this migrant man who was walking across his ranch. That is not enough, I think, to establish any kind of fear that would cause somebody to have to use a weapon. Also, something that I don't think has been talked about enough is he's fired 9 shots. If we're talking about warning shots, usually that's 1, 2, 3. 9 shots to me seems excessive, and it seems to be indicating that on his mind was something a little bit more than warning these folks about being on his property. And then lastly, really this case rose and fell upon Kelly's own admissions. First of all, his interview, he didn't become forthcoming with the investigators until about half an hour in, when he finally admitted that he did fire shots. And then it was his own words who described how he fired. It would be one thing if he said, "I fired warning shots straight up into the air." And think about what a warning shot is. That's something that you're using the sound of that weapon to let people know you have a weapon and you intend to use it if they come any further. But he said he fired over their heads. And I think that was probably a major reason why they filed this case to begin with. And then you have a dead man end up on his property, and you can put two and two together in there and figure out that likely came from Kelly's weapon. But what were the weaknesses as far as the prosecution was concerned? Well, first and foremost and biggest of all was that no bullet was recovered. The fatal bullet that took this man's life was never recovered. When you have a case where you don't have real forensic evidence and you don't have ballistic evidence to make a match to the weapon that was allegedly used, that alone, defense attorneys are going to argue, is reasonable doubt. How can you possibly, beyond a reasonable doubt, tie my client to this death if you're not even able to tie the bullet that took his life to my client's weapon? It's a big question, and it's not something that's insurmountable and something that the prosecution couldn't get around, but I think that obviously was a huge difficulty and hurdle for them in this case. Then I think another thing too is that there were no impartial witnesses to what took place here. You had Kelly's wife who testified, who obviously has her biases that she brings into court. And then for the prosecution, you had a fellow traveler, a fellow migrant with this man who died, who also has his own biases and is also going to bring his own dog to the fight, as it were, when he's testifying. And I think that the jurors probably felt that that was true, that they didn't have really someone who was impartial in this whole thing that they could listen to. But the last thing, and I think something again that hasn't been talked about a whole bunch, is this community lives right on the border. And this community understands violence related to these illegal border crossings, specifically how the cartels are involved in helping people cross that border. And I think they understand that violence is oftentimes attendant to that. And I think that they could imagine that there might be another reason why this man lost his life. I'm not trying to say that that's true. I'm trying to say that that is a reasonable argument that could be made to them. And jurors are told that when they have two equally reasonable explanations for the evidence in front of them, that they're supposed to lean in deference towards the defense. And perhaps that's what happened here, at least with some of those jurors. And then finally, the last question on this is, will prosecutors or should prosecutors even retry the case? Anytime I had a case when I was a prosecutor and it was something that we were looking at retrying, we had hung the first time around, there were two major considerations that we considered. The first was what was the split on the hang? If it was a down the middle split, maybe that doesn't provide us with a whole bunch of helpful information. But if it was heavily weighted towards a conviction, that would make our decision much easier. We might feel that that was much more of a problem with jury selection than anything else. But if it was much more heavily weighted towards a acquittal, it might give us pause. Now, that doesn't mean that means it will never be retried, but it will give prosecutors pause because they're thinking, well, listen, we've kind of done a test run here and it's not convincing to at least the first group of people that we've asked this question to. But the other major question is you have to ask, what would you do different the second time around? Maybe in the first trial, you were not able to call certain witnesses because they weren't available for whatever reason. Or maybe evidence becomes available, certain testing, perhaps they find the bullet. You know, any of these things could definitely change the dynamics of this case that would make it a stronger case or change their decision as far as what they would do differently the second time around. In this case, unless something like that happens, a witness comes forward, they magically find this bullet, something along those lines, you have to ask, what would you do differently? Or would it just be running back the old case? And do you entirely expect a different verdict the second time around? Well, a decision will soon be made on that case. We will obviously be bringing you updates and following it along closely. But it's a very interesting case. It has a lot of kind of political attention attached to it, but it's also just interesting from a legal perspective about proving a difficult case.
Want to teach your kids financial literacy, but not sure where to start? Greenlight can help. With Greenlight, parents can keep an eye on kids' spending and saving, while kids and teens use a card of their own to build money confidence. As a parent, you can send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and more. It's a convenient way to run your household, customized to your family's needs, and the easy way to raise financially smart kids. Get started with Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
I'm Tank Sinatra.
And I'm Investigator Slater.
And together we co-host a podcast called Psychopedia, which is a true crime podcast infused with comedy, making it a crimedy. Each week, Investigator Slater brings us a wild and thoroughly researched true crime case. I'm here to digest it all and react just like you probably are right there on the other side of the microphone.
Somehow, I've got to present each case with the detail and respect it deserves, while also cracking up at Tank's perfectly timed humor and thought-provoking questions.
Listen to and follow Psychopedia on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
We have more breaking news out of New York in a surprising reversal of the Me Too movement's most notorious trial. An appeals court has ruled to overturn the New York convictions of Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein. Over 4 years ago, jurors convicted Weinstein on one charge of committing a criminal sex act in the first degree and a charge of third degree rape. Weinstein was later sentenced to 23 years in prison. After years of fighting the verdict in appeals, judges ruled in a 4-3 decision that Weinstein was unduly prejudiced in his trial due to the use of controversial character evidence. In the trial, the judge allowed evidence of Weinstein's prior bad acts despite those allegations not being charged in the case. An appeals court judge wrote in the ruling, and this is a quote, "It is an abuse of judicial discretion to permit untested allegations of nothing more than bad behavior that destroys a defendant's character but sheds no light on their credibility as related to the criminal charges lodged against them." Very strong wording from the appeals court there. Following the appeal court's ruling, prosecutors with Manhattan District Attorney's Office indicated they plan to retry Weinstein on the charges. You will recall in 2022, Weinstein was also convicted of one count of sexual assault in Los Angeles, with jurors deadlocking or acquitting the mogul on additional charges. For his Los Angeles conviction, Weinstein received a sentence of 16 years, which was to be served concurrently with his New York sentence. While Weinstein is also appealing the verdict, LA prosecutors remain confident the conviction will stand due to California's laws surrounding evidence of prior bad acts. First of all, the question many people have been asking, and you see a lot of reaction to folks online and in the media to this, is did the judges, the appellate judges, get this right? And I will say my feeling is yes, they did. And I know that that may upset many people. And I think many people have a right to be upset, but I think it's best to focus your anger in the right direction. The appeals court are not the ones who are misapplying the law here. I think they're applying the law correctly. It was the trial court judge, the judge that presided over Weinstein's trial in New York, that I think got things wrong and are creating these problems now. Prior bad acts evidence is something that we need to understand. Prior bad acts means conduct that is uncharged that took place before the allegations in the instant case. And they don't even necessarily need to be before. They could be before or after, but essentially what they mean are other uncharged crimes, other uncharged bad acts. They don't even necessarily need to be crimes. And they are allowed in different jurisdictions, have different rules on this, but for the most part, they're allowed to prove things other than character, that being the important part. They can prove things like, did the person have a motive? And is that explained by these prior bad acts? Did they have a common plan? And the list goes on. It's a small list, but there are other things that are enumerated that are allowed to be used, this evidence is to be used for. But what it's not allowed to be used for is simply to attack the defendant's character. In other words, it's not to be used to show propensity. We abhor in this country having a trial based upon who the person is rather than what the person did. We don't want convictions based upon this is an awful person. We want a conviction based upon this person, regardless of who they are, committed this crime and they should be held responsible for it. But when you get into this type of prior bad acts evidence, it's natural for jurors to look at that and go, okay, I have two charged victims here. And then the prosecution in that case presented four additional women who described sexual assault types of behavior that they had encountered when Weinstein. But none of those women had been charged in that case. And what you do, and what jurors I think naturally do and have a hard time avoiding, is they don't accept that evidence for those specific purposes. They look at it and they go, wow, this guy sounds like the type of person. This guy sounds like he's got a propensity to be a person who commits sexual assaults. Therefore, I'm going to believe that he committed the sexual assaults here. That's a huge problem. And it's a huge problem if that type of evidence, even if it's allowed, is not presented properly, because you're asking jurors to split very thin hairs. How can they say to themselves, well, I'm not going to look at this evidence and say, I believe this is the type of person, that he has the character, he has the propensity to commit these crimes, but I'm only going to use it for a very specific purpose. I think it's asking for mental gymnastics that jurors are not prepared to embark on. And so it creates problems. And what the judge in this case and what the appellate court is saying is that by allowing that evidence in, you did not give this man a fair trial. The other part of this was that the judge said that if Weinstein were to testify, the prosecutors could get into other bad acts, things unrelated to sexual assault, things just related to him being a bad guy from decades ago. Well, when confronted with that choice of, do I take the stand, and then they get to hear about every dirty deed I've ever done, even if it's not a crime and even if it took place 10, 20 years ago, I'm not going to take the stand. And that the combination of those two things, allowing this prior bad acts evidence plus the preventing him from taking the stand, created an unfair trial, and the only remedy they could find for that was to give him a new trial. And that is what sounds like going to happen, and maybe rather sooner than later. The last part on this is, could this happen in California? Because California is kind of acting as the safety net now for what took place in New York. He's still facing and still serving time for 16 years in California. And I think he's going to have a more difficult road ahead of him in appeal in California. They're going to raise the same arguments, and the same issues took place in that case. There were other uncharged victims who testified in his California case, but California has laws on the books that specifically allow for propensity evidence. It's an incredibly powerful tool for the prosecution in California to allow specifically for someone in a sex crime type case. There's two cases that allow for this. Sex crimes and domestic violence, but in a sex crimes type case, if you have other prior bad acts of sexual misconduct, they can be used for purposes of proving propensity. And that's nearly insurmountable for a defense. And so I think his appeals pathway is much more difficult for him in California. But we shall see. We will follow this case and, of course, keep you updated to everything as it comes up.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/RS10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/RS10 today.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify is got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Finally, we move on to Miami, Florida, where an OnlyFans model charged with killing her boyfriend was back in court this week, this time not on the murder charge, but for a hearing related to the victim's laptop. Courtney Clenny faces a second-degree murder charge for the stabbing death of her boyfriend, Christian Obomseli, with prosecutors alleging that Clenny and her parents illegally access Obomseli's laptop in an attempt to destroy evidence after the death. Clenny and her parents allegedly obtained the laptop after law enforcement missed the computer in initial sweep of Clenny and Obomseli's home. According to a warrant, Clenny and her parents then discussed potential passwords, trying over a dozen to gain access to the laptop. The Clenny's defense attorney, Frank Prieto, also became a focus in the hearing when prosecutors called on the man to testify at a hearing surrounding the laptop. I can't tell you how rare that is to have the defense attorney testify during a pretrial hearing. Prieto maintained that the family did not change or alter anything on the laptop and testified that his conversations with the Clennys surrounding the device were covered under attorney-client privilege. The judge has not yet made a ruling following the hearing, so we will update you if Clenny and her parents ultimately face charges on that allegation. Meanwhile, Clenny's murder trial does not yet have a start date. All right, let's answer a couple of preliminary questions first. Should they have accessed the laptop? And I'm asking the question of should, not were they allowed to. Were they allowed to is in dispute. But the question of should, I honestly think is no. I think they probably should have turned it over to the police and said, we want whatever is on there. We're entitled to it. Give it to us. But when you try to access it yourself as the defense, these problems are going to arise. This idea of tampering with evidence is going to come up. And you may say, well, listen, they have a right to take a look at that. And if they find something useful, they can use it. And if they find something not useful, they don't have to use it. And that's true. And there's some strategic advantage to that, to saying, well, let's see what's on there first before we decide whether or not to turn this over to the prosecution. But I think that you just run the risk, and it's better practice to have just turned it over. But The bigger question, I think, is should the prosecutors be pursuing charges against the Clenny's parents? And I think the answer to this is also no. This case is a murder case. What are we doing? Why are we spinning our wheels? Why are we off on these side adventures that don't have anything to do with the murder charges? I don't see the advantage of beating up on the parents. The parents, I think, obviously care about their daughter. They're trying to do whatever they can to protect her. I think it was wrong that they accessed it and apparently tried to break into the computer the way that they did, regardless, and putting aside whatever arguments that they had, that that was a mutually used laptop. Leave the parents alone. And I'm not saying that they didn't do anything wrong. I'm just saying, figure out what's important here. This is a murder case. Let's keep our eye on the prize. Let's not distract ourselves. Let's pursue this, and let's not appear as if we're just trying to punish people who are trying to hurt or trying to help their daughter. Now, how does attorney-client privilege play a role in this? Well, a couple of issues here. One, the attorneys apparently gained, the prosecutors, I should say, gained access to communications between the Clenny's and their attorney. And mistake number one made by the prosecution was anytime you're accessing electronic information or large amounts of documents or evidence, the idea of having a clean and dirty team is always best practice. What I mean by that is having a team go in that can look at everything on that electronic device. That's the dirty team. That team is not going to be used at trial. That team is going to separate themselves off, wall themselves off from the actual prosecution team, because if they run across any information that the prosecution should not know about, they've preserved that separation there. And then you have the clean team, and the clean team gets whatever the dirty team decides is not privileged information and can hand that off to the prosecution team, who then is able to do their job without these issues arising. They didn't do that here, and that's a problem. And the other thing is about attorney-client privilege. The attorney, defense attorney here, is claiming that his communications between the parents and him were attorney-client privilege. And it's an interesting argument because I don't know exactly where I fall on this, to be honest with you. They're not his clients. They may have paid for their daughter's defense, but the client is the daughter, is Clenny, is Courtney. She is the one who they have an interest in representing. And the way to think about, well, you know, that's their daughter, aren't they all on the same team? Yes, and that's the argument being made by the defense. But also, what if the daughter's interests somehow become adverse to the parents' interests? What if it's in the daughter's best interest to throw blame about this laptop fiasco at her parents? Now you've got diametrically opposed interests here, and they both can't be represented by the same attorney. So that relationship doesn't really exist. His relationship is with Courtney Clenny, not with the parents. So I think that argument about its attorney-client privilege has some problems. Their argument, the defense team's argument, is that we're all on the same team and that attorney-client privilege doesn't just extend only to the client. It includes investigators and experts and other people and other attorneys who are on the team. And this can include family members, which is true. But in this case where you have the parents who are actually possibly facing criminal charges themselves, they're obviously going to need, I think, their own attorneys. And I think that attorney-client privileged argument starts to break down. But really, the big question is, will any of this have an effect on her upcoming trial? And it really depends on what's on that laptop. If what is on that laptop is helpful to the prosecution, I don't think it affects much of anything at all. But if what is on that laptop is helpful to the defense, now you've got these problems of, did they properly access it? And can the prosecution ask to keep it out because they didn't properly access it? Or they're is possible evidence of tampering, or there is possible evidence of not. And when I say tampering, I don't just mean changing evidence, but perhaps erasing some evidence, but preserving others, other evidence that is only favorable to your client. If those issues come up, then the judge may decide that the only remedy in this case is to exclude the laptop altogether. So it may have an effect. We're going to really have to see what was on the laptop in the end. But my final piece of advice to the prosecutors, if they're listening, which I doubt that they are, is keep your eyes on the prize and just think about this as a murder case and move forward with that. It sounds like you have very convincing evidence of that. But in the meantime, that is our show for this week. We'd like to give a special thank you to our listeners and viewers for tuning in to this very special episode of The Sidebar presented by True Crime Daily. I'm your host, Josh Ritter. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. You can find our Sidebar episodes wherever you get your podcasts, and we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments you'd like us to address, tweet us your questions with the hashtag TCDSidebar. We always appreciate your feedback and we appreciate you. Thank you again for joining us at the True Crime Daily Sidebar.